This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, federal and Oregon officials have designed a flexible approach to save the coho salmon. Environmentalists call it a disaster. We talk green about the potential danger posed by chemicals which may mimic hormones in humans and wildlife. A portrait of East Tennessee hills where the people are wed to the land. And in the Earth calendar, bison on the tall grass prairie slow down their stampede long enough to give birth. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Action by the Clinton administration and Oregon Governor Kitzhaber to save coho salmon are putting in issue the Federal Endangered Species Act itself. Populations of coho salmon in Northern California and Oregon have been declining, so much so that the National Marine Fisheries Service has just gone through a process to determine whether the coho should be listed as threatened or endangered. What the Fisheries Service did was to list the coho in California and on the southern Oregon border, but not to list it in Oregon. The service did not list in Oregon in part because they found that the state protection plan made listing unnecessary. Jim Leckie, chief of the Protected Species Division for the National Marine Fisheries Service for the Southwest Region, explained.
Oregon has made a major investment in coho recovery and a major commitment to implementing their recovery plan, and they get credit for that in the listing determination.
Is the plan which the state put together regarded as sufficient to at least delay the necessity for listing at this point?
Yes. Combined with the relative health of the coastal population, that's true. The plan makes major changes in the ocean harvest strategy. It also resolves many of the problems that have arisen out of massive hatchery programs in the past, and it begins to work on many of the freshwater habitat issues. We think there's room for improvement there, and we have an agreement with Oregon that under which Fisheries Service and Oregon will work to resolve some of the differences we have about the freshwater habitat part of their plan.
I presume the differences with respect to the freshwater habitat relate to further control of logging practices. Is that correct?
We would like to see some additional modifications to their forest practice rules.
Paula Burgess, Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's assistant for natural resources, says the negotiated plan is preferable to listing because the state has gotten concessions from landowners which could not be achieved through the listing process. And this is where the conflict arises. Environmental groups charge that the plan is nothing more than an agreement to negotiate with the timber industry about forest practices like not cutting on steep slopes and along stream beds, something the industry has been reluctant to do. Without binding commitments in place, environmentalists say the plan is inadequate to protect salmon. Diane Valentine is the salmon protection advocate for the Oregon Natural Resources Council, an environmental group which is suing the Fisheries Service over its refusal to list the coho.
There's promises made that something's going to happen in the future. And under the Endangered Species Act, under the law, there's no provision for avoiding a listing based on promises. It has to be based on existing regulatory mechanisms and the adequacy or inadequacy of those. Basically, this memorandum of agreement that's been signed between the federal agency and the state of Oregon says that over the course of the next 6 months, the federal and the state governments are going to work together to come up with some increased, improved forest protections. And basically, the state of Oregon has 2 years from today to actually implement any of those. It is promising to do so in a quick and forthright manner, but again, these are just promises. It's very hard for us to have faith in promises when, during the whole course of designing this plan, the forest industry refused to cooperate with any kind of increases in protections. And now we're being told, well, they're going to do it in the next 2 years, and if it doesn't happen in the next 2 years, then perhaps the National Marine Fisheries Service will list the coho. So basically what we're seeing is just more promises and more delays.
Speaking for the Fisheries Service, Jim Leckie agrees that modifications are needed in forest practice rules and restoration of streams is necessary, but he does not think the Oregon plan is inadequate. A similar dispute in Texas resulted in judgment against the government. He says this one is different.
This is a plan that's of much greater proportions than the one in Texas. It has a much higher level of commitment by the state government, and the state actually has been implementing this plan for a couple of years. So the state, we have signed a memorandum of understanding with the governor's office in Oregon, and the state legislature has passed legislation to provide substantial amount of funding to ensure that this plan is fully implemented.
The Clinton administration approach to enforcement of the Endangered Species Act by negotiating protection plans with states and landowners as an alternative to listing is regarded by enforcement agencies and the state of Oregon as an effective and flexible strategy. Also, it may diminish the pressure in Congress to repeal the Endangered Species Act altogether. But to the Oregon Natural Resources Council, it's a cynical abdication of responsibility.
I think that the Clinton administration knows that it's very legally vulnerable here. I think they really know that they are not following the letter or the spirit of the Endangered Species Act with this decision and many of their other decisions. But I think they've just made a conscious decision that they're going to put this on the backs of the environmental community. Yeah.
That was Diane Valentine. Three things now hang in the balance in Oregon. First, the future of the coho itself. Is the Oregon plan strong enough to save it? Second is whether listing under the Endangered Species Act can be avoided on the basis of a state-negotiated recovery and protection plan. And third, whether the Clinton administration's flexible approach to endangered species protection through negotiated settlements can survive legal challenge. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about hormones that interfere with the reproductive systems of animals and humans. They're called endocrine disruptors, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Questions about endocrine disruptors gained widespread attention with the publication a year ago of a book entitled Our Stolen Future, Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? The book suggests there's a growing evidence that a broad range of synthetic chemicals are disrupting animal and human hormonal systems. Here to help us understand what all this means and what has happened since the release of the book is co-author Diane Dumanowski. She co-authored the book with Theo Colburn and John Peterson Myers. Diane Dumanowski has reported on national and global environmental issues for the Boston Globe, and she's in Massachusetts. Also with us is Sheldon Krimsky. He's professor of urban and environmental policy at Tufts University, and he's done extensive research on science, ethics, and public policy. Diane, before we talk about what's happened in the years since the book was published, tell us briefly what it's all about and why it has stirred so much controversy.
Since Silent Spring, which Rachel Carson wrote in 1962, we've been operating according to a simple notion that toxic chemicals equal cancer. That's really dominated our thinking and our policy. What our stolen future does is say that we have to move beyond cancer in our thinking. And in fact, it argues that in our obsession with cancer, we've overlooked other important health effects. And these include the disruption of development early in life with consequences that might involve impaired reproduction, brain and behavioral effects, and suppressed immune systems. I think the book has caused a lot of controversy because it raises some important questions. It points to alarming symptoms that are being reported in the medical literature, such as declining human sperm count levels. So this has obviously seized the public attention and caused a lot of debate.
Well, the scary thing about it, as I read the book, was that while we have had this huge regulatory apparatus set up to figure out what doses of what give you cancer, what you're saying is that there are dangers that really have to do with how life is put together at the very basics, how we reproduce and so on, that nobody's even thought about while they were chasing down the cancer path. Is that the message?
Yes, that's the message. There are an estimated 80 to 100,000 synthetic chemicals that we put into the environment since World War II, and most of these chemicals have not been tested for the kinds of effects and the questions that are raised in our stolen future.
Sheldon Krimsky is a student of public policy and ethics and so on. You must have seen many cases in which scientists have put forward theories and then they kind of go by the wayside. Is the Stolen Future book a call to action as Silent Spring was, or will it be dismissed as 1990s media hype in a new form?
Well, I think that our Stolen Future is already having an important impact in getting the scientific community to focus attention on many of these questions. Whether it will have the legacy of Silent Spring is yet to be determined.
And, of course, the spooky thing about this one is that it may be a generation or even two generations later that the full impact is understood.
Correct. And it also may be the effects are subtle and spread throughout the population. And it may be difficult to pick them out.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and we have a call from Natalie in Pennsylvania. Natalie, you're talking Green in the Environment Show.
Hi. I was wondering what social implications you foresee coming out of the endocrine disruptor issue, and if you think that people will become more fearful or more apathetic about these chemicals since they seem to be everywhere.
That is a good question. Let's hear from you both on that. Diane.
Well, it's pretty difficult to say whether they're going to become more fearful or more apathetic. I think it depends on whether they feel they can do anything about it. And in our Stolen Future, we do have a chapter called Defending Ourselves, where we talk about many steps, from personal steps to community steps to steps that might be taken by national governments to steps that are going to be required, that are going to require international cooperation and perhaps international treaties. I think people only become apathetic if they feel there's nothing that they can do about it, and we hope we didn't leave readers in that position.
Natalie, thanks for your question. I have an email question here from Jonathan in Nashville. And he asks, are you saying that we should ban pesticides? And if we do, wouldn't that create starvation and disease that would be more difficult than an unproven speculation about reproductive disorders? Diane, what do you think?
Well, our book doesn't call for a total ban on pesticides. We really talk about a need to screen these compounds to find out which pesticides and inert ingredients are endocrine disrupting. And in general, we call for a more selective use of pesticides. We're basically saying that we don't think, whether they're endocrine disruptors or not, pesticides are poisons by design. So we're basically urging that people stop using pesticides for frivolous or cosmetic purposes, such as home and garden applications.
One of the questions, of course, is we understand an industry that's going to defend its cash flow, but I'm sure there are scientists on both sides of this issue that see it in different degrees of severity. Sheldon, has there been broad splits in the scientific community on these issues?
There are clearly some divisions, and I think even the scientists who feel like this is a strong hypothesis and has to be investigated thoroughly are not convinced that we yet have the evidence that human exposures to ambient or to, you know, the kinds of chemicals that have been brought out in the book, that human exposures are yet known to be correlated with human disease.
And so the argument there is, if not known, then we shouldn't act because that might cause disruption.
Well, not necessarily. We have in the European community something called the precautionary principle. We haven't quite adopted that in the United States yet, but it says if you have strong suspicion that something is causing harm to animals, even though you don't have definitive evidence that it's causing harm to humans, that you may want to take precautions.
This raises, I think, an question that came to us from Alice in Atlanta by email. She asks, as a woman of childbearing age, what should I do to minimize risk from endocrine disruption?
Well, we in the chapter Defending Ourselves, we discussed various measures that individuals can take, and they range from not microwaving in plastic until we have better consumer information about which plastics are safe, because heat will accelerate the migration of these compounds into the food. The other kinds of actions that an individual can take is to religiously observe fish advisories. The other thing is that if the dietary recommendations that emerge from this issue are the same as those that emerge to prevent cancer and heart disease. If one were to eat less animal fat, eat lower on the food web, more fruits, vegetables, and grains, then you would be protecting your health, because a lot of these, particularly the persistent hormone-disrupting compounds, tend to travel through animal fat. So anything that is fatty and at the top of the food web is likely to carry a lot of contaminants.
Okay, well, I'm afraid our time is up. Our guests have been Diane Domanowski, who is a co-author of the book Our Stolen Future, and Sheldon Krimsky, who is professor of urban and environmental policy at Tufts University. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Author Gary Ferguson traveled 4,000 miles across a handful of the last great forests in America and presents a portrait of the East Tennessee hills. His book, Sylvan Path, is published by St. Martin's Press. It celebrates the beauty of these woods and the people whose lives are firmly wed to them.
If I hadn't already lost my heart to the woods of East Tennessee, I would have lost it again tonight, Saturday, at the end of a long drive on a web of dirt roads, hopscotching past hand-painted signs with big blue arrows pointing me ever on to the foot of Laurel Mountain and hillbillies. I park on the grass along with at least 50 other cars, walk across a patch of open ground below a modest house wrapped in tar paper to the base of a grand run of forest. The trunks of the trees wear patchy, threadbare coats of lichen the color of olives and chalk. The air smells like ginger and pepper and bags of peat. At the edge of the woods, some 150 folding chairs are set up in the open air, facing a small wooden stage where six musicians who live nearby, five from the same family, are plucking and singing great licks of bluegrass, every now and then someone climbing up from the audience to belt out a song or two about some lost darling or a homesick tale about missing the sweet hills of Tennessee. Between the stage and the chairs, 80-year-old men in overalls and 6-year-old kids, middle-aged women in cotton dresses, and teenagers, too, are all crowded together, spilling out a hearty mix of buck dancing and flatfoot, every kick sending clouds of cornmeal and grits flying up from the wooden floor. After a while, a couple of old woodcutters, Frank and Arliss, join me, and before long they're telling me about the finer points of sawing. "The balance is a thing," Arliss is saying. "It's a rocking motion, and the guy dragging the blade back has to be willing to pull up, and then push down as he moves it forward again. If you don't lift up when you're dragging back, it damn near kills the guy you're sawing with." Over the course of an hour, I hear plenty more. How often you need to sharpen a saw if you're cutting oak or hickory, as opposed to white pine or poplar. That hitting a hemlock knot is like trying to saw through glass. And finally, how it takes two people to drink moonshine. One holds a shotgun to your head to get you to take a drink, and then you trade off. The truth is, the only thing as good as the music and the dancing are the stories, enough to fill up a whole holler. Stories about moonshine and midwives, even about church. "More churches you have," says one old-timer, "more split apart people get, less they stand together. You make some moonshine here in these woods, somebody turns you in, it's always somebody from another church. There's no getting on together. I make camp for the night, my last night, at the end of a rutted dirt road that twists for a mile through deep woods, finally petering out on the bank of the French Broad River. The place is totally without people, completely quiet, though on the weekends it's clearly a party spot, one of those hidden corners where rural kids come to drink beer and smash bottles into rocks, throw up in the sand among the willows. The recent rains have picked up a million armloads of dirt from the surrounding hills and dumped them into the river, overwhelming it, turning it into what looks like a channel of coffee and cream, stirred by the cottonwood snags it's plucked off the high banks. It has a heavy sound to it, rolling through this dark night, keeping me awake, a kind of white noise gone to black. I try to ignore it, then, out of boredom, end up tracing its route in my mind, thinking of it pouring out of the hills to join the Tennessee, heading south into Alabama, finally north again, all the way through Kentucky to the Ohio River. But in the end, that just leaves me thinking about going, and what I really want to do is stay.
Gary Ferguson, author of The Sylvan Path, A Journey Through America's Forests, published by St. Martin's Press. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. This is calving season for bison on the Tallgrass Preserve, which runs through parts of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska. Bob Hamilton is the director of science and stewardship there and says they want to bring the bison herd up to about 2,000.
We're probably a little over halfway through our spring calving season right now, and they really got to going this year about mid-April, and we're expecting about 200 calves this spring, so we're a little bit over halfway done right now.
Bison are large animals. Bulls weigh in at around 1,600 pounds. Despite their size, they can run at 40 miles per hour for sustained periods of time. Adult bison are stately creatures with large mane around their neck, but Hamilton says they look different when they're born.
They're pretty small. They're, in the neighborhood of probably 40 to 60 pounds. Little red guys, kind of a cinnamon red color when they're first born, kind of an Irish setter red. And they lose that at about 2 to 3 months of age. They go through a fairly awkward, sort of geeky-looking adolescent phase where they're molting and changing to the darker adult color.
Bison are nomadic animals, roaming about 3 or 4 miles in a day just by grazing. When herds are spooked, they can go much farther than that. One herd recently in Canada ran 60 kilometers to get away from a pack of wolves. So when bison cows are calving, they need to do it quickly. Bob Hamilton says bison calves are easy prey for predators and know they need to keep up with a herd.
They usually give birth laying down. It's fairly quick sort of enterprise, and typically what you'll see is you'll see a cow that's dropped off from the rest of the herd. They're constantly moving. I mean, when they're grazing, they're constantly moving. You know, they take a bite, take a step, take a bite, take a step. The calf typically, immediately is trying to get on its feet, and usually within 30 or 40 minutes or so, they're able to stand up, and within an hour, they're moving on with their mom.
The Tallgrass Prairie Preserve is over 35,000 acres, of which bison have nearly total free reign. The preserve is not a national park, but is instead owned by the Nature Conservancy. Its goal is to mimic as closely as possible the natural conditions which existed before European settlement, when there were 30 to 60 million bison spread up and down the interior of North America. Today, there are about 200,000 bison. Bob Hamilton says many of the plants on the Tallgrass Prairie rely on the animals.
The reason we introduced them, or we're interested in reintroducing them, is because they're such an important part of the historical mechanics of the ecosystem. If you really want to try to preserve the plants and animals and natural communities in a vegetation type like this, you have to put it back under the forces of nature that originally created and maintained that landscape. And we know historically that was primarily grazing and fire. And so we've brought back both those forces.
Bison are well suited to the prairie because almost their entire diet consists of grass. Unlike cattle, they tend to leave other plants like wildflowers alone. So if you have grass in your flower beds, try introducing bison. If they eat the flowers anyway, you can always eat the bison. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, cars and trucks account for over half the air pollution in urban areas. Now, a generation of cleaner cars are about to hit the streets, while automakers spend billions of dollars to capture the market. A conversation with scientist Gene Likens. He says while progress has been made, the Clean Air Act is not strong enough to stop acid rain. We'll hear about bonobo apes of West Africa. They share 98% of our genetic makeup, yet we know amazingly little about them. A portrait of a silent city on the plains of Minnesota. And the musical duo of Peter and Lou Berryman toast Mother Nature. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. The race is on. Automakers around the world are competing to make the cars and trucks we drive cleaner. A new generation of technology is about to reach the market, fueled by concerns over air pollution and global warming. But critics charge vehicles which run on electricity and other alternative fuels aren't ready to compete with their gas-guzzling counterparts. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally catches up with the annual Tour de Sol electric car rally to see what's new for this year.
For the past 9 years, people have been gathering in New England to drive their alternative-fueled vehicles hundreds of miles. At first, the Tour de Sol looked like a collection of ragtag science projects on wheels. But the technology has improved in a very short time, and entrants these days represent the most sophisticated things on four wheels. Tom Thompson is the executive director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, which sponsors the road rally.
We are in Northampton, Massachusetts. And today we're going to do the longest leg of the 9-day event. We're going to do 107 miles. We're going to go from Northampton to Greenfield, Massachusetts. We'll have a public display there. And then from there we head up to Bellows Falls, Vermont for another public display for school children and the general public. And then we'll finish off the night in White River Junction.
From there the rally will head over the White Mountains of New Hampshire and end in Portland, Maine. The cars will have traveled 400 miles. That may seem like a lot for electric cars, but last year the world distance record was set at the race by a Solectria car at 375 miles on a single charge. Prices for those kind of cars are still too high for all but the wealthiest people, but as automakers invest billions of dollars, significantly cleaner cars will become available. For instance, Toyota is spending $800 million, half of its research and development budget, on alternative fueled vehicles. Thompson says the challenge now is making sure American companies are not left behind by their foreign competition.
And the same thing will happen in the 90s as what happened in the 70s with the first worldwide oil embargo, and the Toyotas and the Hondas, which I've mentioned already, are either introducing or have already introduced electric vehicles. The danger is that the United States could lose the lead to foreign producers.
Concern over the environment is the force behind these changes. The American Lung Association calls air pollution the number one health threat in this country. And transportation causes 60 to 90% of the air pollution in urban areas. Even some rural areas today have air labeled unhealthy by the government. Jason Mark is a transportation analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says the problem is that while cars have gotten much cleaner over the years, Americans are driving more miles and buying more cars.
Well, in a world where the automobile population is doubling every 25 to 50 years, it's almost imperative that we move our transportation system to a lower polluting, lower energy consuming system.
And it's not just environmentalists who are saying this. Two major projects are looming on the horizon, which will make it much harder and even illegal to have bad air. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency wants to tighten air pollution laws, and the U.S. is expected to sign a climate change treaty this December, which may bind us to cutting back on carbon dioxide. The main target of both these actions will be cars and trucks. Jason Marks says a major shift has to take place in order to reach these goals. He says the most promising technologies are just now coming to market.
I think there's a small family of promising transportation technologies. And those all have a sort of a common technological thread. They're powered by an electric drive system. So in other words, instead of having a set of gears and transmissions and mechanical wheels and axles, instead they would have electric motors sitting right at the wheels of the car. But those are the beginnings, and I'd say the predecessors to a range of electric drive technologies that include a hybrid electric car as well as a fuel cell powered car that hold particular promise both for clean and efficient transportation.
Fuel cells, which combine hydrogen and oxygen, are being touted as the most promising energy source for cars in the next decade or two. They work by combining hydrogen and oxygen to produce heat. The only byproduct is water. But even this and other new technology are not totally clean. Fuel cells today run mostly on natural gas, and electric cars are almost always powered by energy from power plants. Tom Thompson says the goal is to run cars and the rest of the world on renewable energy. Though that day may be far off, he says cleaner cars are right around the corner, to the point where an event like the Tour de Sol won't be necessary soon.
Well, what we say here is that the sad news is that the day will come when the Tour de Sol, as we know it, will not happen. But when that happens, it will be on the heels of the reality that the American Tour de Sol will happen every day as Americans all across the country open up their garage doors and back electric vehicles out of their driveway as they head to work.
The only electric car available in this country is General Motors EV1. But this summer, a Toyota car will hit the market in Southern California. Ford and Honda say they will introduce cars soon as well. Meanwhile, if investment money is any indication, the range of options will continue to grow. Germany's Daimler-Benz recently signed a $500 million contract with fuel cell maker Ballard Power Systems. So after years of hearing about alternative fuel vehicles, you may actually be sharing the road with them soon. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Are we making any progress in reducing acid rain? In 1990, President Bush and his Environmental Protection Administrator, William Riley, pushed by thousands of environmental activists, managed to break the logjam in Congress, and amendments were passed to the Clean Air Act. Those amendments were designed to put an end to acid rain, which has been damaging lakes and ponds and forests, particularly in the eastern portion of the country. Acid rain is formed when sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide are discharged in the atmosphere. They mix with other pollutants, they're exposed to sunlight, moisture, and then pushed, usually eastward by prevailing winds. The resulting chemical stew becomes acid rain. I asked Dr. Gene Likens, director of the Institute of Ecosystem Studies at Millbrook, New York, and a research scientist who has been studying acid rain and its effects for decades, whether the 1990 amendments have had any effect.
Well, we've made a lot of progress, I think, in dealing with acid rain. And again, I think the science, the input that scientists have made in clarifying, again, another extremely complex problem in trying to clarify this complex problem through science, I think has been extraordinarily important in guiding our policy and decision makers. So we've made a lot of progress, and as you know, the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act for the first time focused on acid rain and trying to resolve this problem. Unfortunately, that act focused most extensively on sulfur, And we know, and we've known for a long time, that it's more than sulfur involved in this problem. I think the reason the Act focused on sulfur was that it was an expedient thing to do. But we're going to have to take some other action. We're going to have to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions to the atmosphere.
And that's primarily automobile exhaust, isn't
that's,
it?
That's right. And we're going to have to do that because the nitrogen oxide emissions to the atmosphere contribute to nitric acid, and that's a co-strong acid in the acid rain issue. It's sulfuric acid, which comes from sulfur, and nitric acid, which comes from the nitric acid, the nitrogen dioxide, and other oxide emissions. So that's an important consideration that it's left undone, really.
To further reduce acid rain, Likens would like to see additional amendments to the Clean Air Act, including a 30% to 50% reduction of nitrogen emissions to the atmosphere, a further reduction in sulfur, and a modification of the program that allows a polluter who has reduced emissions more than required by law to sell pollution credits to someone else. He says that industries that affect the Northeast, where acid rain is a real problem, should not be allowed to continue polluting simply by buying credits from some other part of the country where acid rain does not exist. If Likens is right, that a 30 to 50% reduction in nitrous oxides will be necessary to completely stop acid rain, it appears that major changes in the use and design of the automobile will be required. The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind and give us your questions about the environment. You can visit us anytime over the internet where you can hear the Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/ENVSHOW. Joining us now is Stephanie Goichman with an update on your comments. What have we got this week, Stephanie?
Well, Peter, we received quite a few comments over the past few weeks in response to our Talking Green segment on mountain lions. This one in particular was from a man in West Virginia. He says, quote, "As a hunter in West Virginia, I could have killed it, but I realized that my family had been pioneers in that area back in the 18th century, and I realized man is destroying everything. That's the last time I ever went hunting. We were face to face. It was in the mountains overlooking the Ohio River. And it was just an incredible experience coming face to face with a magnificent animal," end quote.
Here's a man who looked into the eyes of the beast and found his soul.
And we received other comments about mountain lions.
Hi, my name is Bruce Percival. I'm calling on a cell phone. My uncle has seen a mountain lion here in northern New York State. And if the mountain lion and any other larger predators, even bobcats, which aren't quite so large, but if they're going to continue to survive, and I think it's important that they survive, we're going to have some space where the humans haven't just torn everything all to pieces and built houses and little parks and little shopping centers and every other darn thing. And contrary to what some of the listeners are going to believe, hunting, selected game management through hunting is not, I don't perceive that as a real problem.
Norma Peterson, Stamford, New York. I come from Bergen County, New Jersey, and a neighbor's son is a rock hound and makes his living that way. He told me a story that he was, I believe, in the Carolinas, in the mountains, camping, and of course rock hunting. And he had moved away about 1 or 2 in the morning from the campsite because he couldn't sleep, and he moved into a clearing, sitting on a stump, and for a long time. He said maybe an hour or something like that, sitting quietly watching the stars and just absorbing it. And something brushed against his leg, and he said he looked down, and he doesn't know who was more startled. He jumped one way, and the cougar jumped the other way. But it was such a marvelous experience and unforgettable. I thought I would like to share it with you. Enjoy your show. Thank you.
What else did folks call about?
After a lively segment on nuclear power, our listeners called us with their own radiation.
Hi, my name is Bill Bach in Oswego, New York. The fact that nuclear power is one thing that is saving our environment from lots of greenhouse gases, I found it interesting. Right before you started nuclear power, you're talking about global warming and all the concerns with that. Thank you.
My name is Mark Nix in Poughkeepsie, New York. I want to make a comment on the power situation where everybody's getting all concerned about nuclear power. Has anybody ever thought of the or heard of the term combined cycle? This has gone from a massive technology that's been going by leaps and bounds. It's gone from peaking units to getting into base loads now, and burns very clean, very efficient, approaches 70% efficiency ratings. It's a big step in technology, and it's definitely going places.
Well, Peter, that's about all we have time for, but we'll be back next week.
Thanks, Stephanie. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Give us a call. Living deep in the jungles of the Congo, known until just recently as Zaire, are a little-known species of ape called bonobos. Classified in 1929, they were one of the last large mammals to be known to science. We still don't know much about them, yet they share 98% of our genetic profile. In fact, bonobos may be the animal most similar to humans. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally spoke with Francis Duwall, author of the book Bonobo, the Forgotten Ape.
There are only four ape species, the orangutan, the gorilla, the chimpanzee, and the bonobo. And everyone knows the other three, but very few people know the bonobo. And the bonobo is just as close to us as is the chimpanzee. And so it's a very close relative.
You explain in the, or you say in the book, that in everything they do, they resemble us. Just explain what you mean by that.
Well, they have a lot of facial expressions and gestures that are very human-like. So, for example, bonobos are very sexy creatures, and so they have facial expressions when they have sex. They have aggressive expressions, of course, playful expressions that look a lot like laughing, and when they are playing, they make sounds that sound like laughing. And so in many ways, when they communicate with each other, they look extremely human-like. And in addition, their sexual behavior is very human-like. Their social organization has certain things in common with humans, and so on.
Yeah, now, explain their social life. Who is in charge, and how is it structured?
That's a big contrast with the chimpanzees, in the sense that chimpanzees are a male-bonded society, where the males clearly dominate the females, and the males are extremely territorial and have big fights with males next doors. In the bonobo, that's all completely changed. The females seem to be in charge. The females are closely bonded. The males are actually quite competitive among themselves, more so than chimpanzee males, it seems. The females dominate the males in that they can claim resources. So, for example, if a group of bonobos enters a fruit tree in the field, it's going to be the females first.
Now, I know that sex figures prominently in their social life. Just explain the role of, and we can go into this further, but how does sex work in bonobo society?
Well, the bonobos are probably the sexiest primates that exist. Maybe we would compete with them for that title, but they have very frequent sex and in all combinations of individuals and in all possible positions. So in terms of combinations, you have lots of female-female sex, for example. Partly, this power of females, the alliances that the females form, is reinforced by sexual interactions between them. Now, so they use the sex partly for bonding, partly to eliminate tension. So a very typical situation where bonobos will engage in sex is when you throw food into the enclosure in captivity, for example, and they start competing over the food, but instead of really competing, they immediately have sex, and then they start sharing the food. And so it seems almost as if the sexual interaction serves to create some level of tolerance that then makes food sharing possible. And so we usually describe sex in bonobos as the glue of society. It's the way they resolve tensions and conflict. And that's also why it is used in all combinations of individuals, because obviously conflicts are not only occurring between a male and a female, but in all possible combinations.
And finally, this is more of a philosophical question, but what can we learn from the bonobos? What do they have to teach us?
Well, what we learn is that there is probably more flexibility in our direct lineage than we used to assume. We have for 25 years, since Robert Ardrey and Desmond Morris and Conrad Lawrence, for 25 years we have had these models of human behavior, human evolution, that heavily emphasized warfare, hunting, a lot of aggressive male tendencies, in the sense that we conquered the world, you know, through genocide. That's the sort of the image that has been projected of our species. And chimpanzees have, to some degree, supported that view, although I hold the view that chimpanzees can also be awfully nice to each other, and I've seen many instances of that, and so I don't want to depict a chimpanzee here as necessarily all aggressive. Now, if you look at the bonobo, which is equally close to us as a chimpanzee, you get a completely different image. It's not Hobbesian, it's more Rousseauian almost. And so the bonobo is relatively peaceful, sexy. Females are in charge. They get along fine most of the time. And so they put question marks behind that model, because the original model that emphasized our aggressive tendencies and our instinctual aggression so much really depicted that as a general primate tendency, something that we got automatically, biologically. And if such a close relative can be so different, I think that questions that whole model, and we should start rethinking if there are not some other tendencies like cooperation, for example, and language and morality and so on, that have been equally important in our evolution.
Frans de Waal and photographer Frans Lanting are the authors of Bonobo, The Forgotten Ape. Frans de Waal spoke with producer Thomas Lally. The bonobos are amazing creatures. Few other primates share their zest for peace. Certainly humans could take a lesson or two from them, though their penchant for sex may offend the moral majority. But while war is foreign to bonobos, it's all too common for us. Kent Nerburn is the author of A Haunting Reverence, Meditations on a Northern Land. He presents a portrait of a place in his home state of Minnesota called Silent City, where a war once took place, but now only ghosts remain.
There is a place not far from my home that the Indians call Silent City. It is just a field, no different than so many others, dotted with the occasional oak and covered in summer with nondescript dun grasses. In the winter, snow drifts across it with democratic impunity. Even it can find no reason to stop here. But someone did stop here. In this field, so carefully carried in memory by the Ojibwe, two groups of men surprised each other. The one, Ojibwe, was seeking room to live and hunt as their people were pushed deeper into the woodlands by the coming of the European. The other, Sioux, were struggling to retain a foothold in the woodlands as they were pushed ever and further onto the treeless prairies to the west. Here, in this field, too sparse to be called woods, too ordinary to be called prairie, they met and fought. The Ojibwe, more conversant with the whites, had procured more guns. The Sioux, perhaps sensing that their destiny was in the open west, were fighting in retreat. All the forces, save bravery and honor, weighed in favor of the Ojibwe, and the outcome, save for bravery and honor, went their way. As the battle closed, so memory goes, in this field lay slain 100 Sioux warriors. Young men dying to protect their families, old men dying to protect their honor, killed by arrow, bullet, and cudgel, dying quickly, dying slowly, dying far from their families and far from history, committing their spirits to the soil, to the field, to Silent City. Now the Ojibwe say, there are the voices. Here on this desolate part of their land, so sparsely settled that one goes for miles on gravel roads to even find a house. Here, where water lives so close to the surface that the rains can turn the field to swamp. Here, where life is so spare that only the small and scuttling of the animal people can survive. The voices can be heard. Crying, screaming, moaning, speaking not the language of the Ojibwe, but the language of the Sioux. Who is to say how one claims the land? Who is to say how one claims the land? To plot, to measure, to till, to pay in cash or in blood, to trod the land for 1,000 years, to bury our parents and our children upon it? None of these will guarantee our claim. It is for the land, and the land alone, to decide. Somewhere, miles from here, standing lonely on a windswept Dakota prairie, a woman lifts her heart and cries her grandfather's name. Somewhere, close to here, in a treeless, barren field, two boys stop their play and hear a moaning in the wind.
Ken Urban is the author of A Haunting Reverence, Meditations on a Northern Land, published by the New World Library. Keeping Mother Nature alive and well is a tough job. Businesses complain that environmental regulations curtail their activities. And good people the world over spend many hours working to keep the environment healthy. Lou and Peter Berryman are folk musicians from Madison, Wisconsin. In their song, Here's to Mother Nature, they praise her hard work, but wonder whether the world would be a better place without her. The song appears in their release, Cow Imagination, on Corn Belt Records.
She made the Georgia peaches, the California beaches, the cliffs along the Moonlight Bay. The lindens and the larches, the metatarsal arches, molybdenum and DNA. Here's to Mother Nature, here's to Mother Nature, for dreaming of the moon and sun. We better break it gently, it seems that evidently nearly all our work is done. And she's been standing in the way of progress. Someone ought to set her down. Except for Copper Window Boxes, she doesn't have a place in town. We appreciate her effort, but we ought to make it clear she's standing in the way of progress. We can take it on from here.
Here's to Mother Nature by Lou and Peter Berryman off their release, Cow Imagination, on Corn Belt Records. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 386. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.